You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Good afternoon, Matt, and here is Mochi the cat. And here is my dad's hairdo, which is really bad.
So those who are listening to the podcast are not seeing the visual. During the inauguration speech, my children did my hair.
And, turn around so the people who are watching see the ponytail.
Ponytail. And there's like a bunch of ponytails. So it's like one coming out from the side, then the other
it's
side.
Kind of looks up and one up the side. So it kind of looks it could almost be a cultural appropriation type situation.
Well, you can take that up with my stylist.
Yeah. Wait, what does he want to take up? What's he want to take
any,
up?
Any what? Controversies around my hair?
What does that mean?
Controversy, disagreements.
Anyone's got any disagreements around hair? Because if they do, they're in big trouble with me.
Well, you heard it here on the DMZ. I told them I'd start the show with the hairdo, but I think we should move on.
I think it looks, let me just say, I think it looks pretty badass, except I'd go with like black bands instead of those pink and blue. I think if it was just a regular black band.
Well, you don't know. You don't know what's hip on the streets these days, Matt.
I'm a little out of touch, I'm going to admit. I think there was a time when maybe I did kind of know what was cool, but I think those days have passed us by, Bill.
So we are 1 hour in the Biden presidency, what are you so excited about? You didn't vote for it. You copped out.
I just need to exhale. the stress that I've been carrying.
I always said, Matt, in your heart, you wanted Biden to win, but you couldn't vote for him.
It's a different world. Bill, it's quieter. Food tastes better. Air smells fresher.
So did Biden do in his inaugural address what you wanted him to do?
Exactly what I wanted him to do. He's done everything pretty much. He's a couple of missteps here and there, but pretty much he's done exactly what I thought he should do for the last year or more. And it was a somewhat of a boring speech filled with platitudes, and I loved every minute of it. That's what I want. That's exactly what this country. It's the man meets the moment is what this is.
You know, I mean, I would have these arguments with folks over the course of the campaign where Biden would talk about bipartisanship, and I would say, I don't think this guy's going to nuke the filibuster. I don't think he's going to pack the court. And people would say to me, oh, this is just campaign platitudes. I'm like, yeah, but Biden believes these campaign platitudes. He's not just checking boxes. This is very much ingrained in his soul. And he's been saying these things for an exceedingly long time. And I think when you give the platitudes with sincerity and feeling, they have a much different resonance than if you're just, you know, mouthing the words some speechwriter gave you.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I also think the platitude, this is a point others have made on Twitter. It's not original to me, but I think it's true. The platitudes, in the context of Donald Trump, saying platitudes means something. Like, it's not just words. It's in the context and the contrast of Trump, they are much more powerful. So just having a president say things that would have been very normal in the past means a lot more right now. So,
does it have any substantive impact going forward? Is it just a nice day? We all get along today, and then tomorrow, the knives are back out.
I do think there's substance, but not substance in the sense of policy specifics. I think the Joe Biden's mandate all along has been to not be Trump and to be a uniter and a healer and all that. And in that regard, I think that this is living out that message. This is day one. This is day one of living out that message. Can he keep it up? We'll have to see.
Well, you wrote this week a kind of pessimistic piece, thinking that Biden can't keep it up.
Well, you're ahead of me, Bill, because that has not been published yet.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
That's okay. But no, we should talk about it because there is something brewing that does, I think, threaten to derail to derail this era of good feeling. And that is reports that after these executive orders, which I think are pretty anodyne and by and large, a couple of them I have a problem with, but by and large, they're going to be popular. But that very early, Joe Biden is going to champion comprehensive immigration reform, i.e. amnesty, without, so it's a pathway to citizenship, reportedly, for 11 or 12 million undocumented immigrants.
But it's not an instant amnesty. It's a pathway. You gotta clear a lot of hurdles the way it was in the 2013 bill.
Fair point. And I criticized it when they called it amnesty back then, so I guess I shouldn't use that term. But the concern is that it will reportedly not have any sort of border security component, which, as you know, Bill, was sort of used to entice Republicans and even people like Joe Manchin, the West Virginia Democratic senator, to support the bill in 2013. And so David Frum, who is a pretty ardent never Trumper, had a tweet where he was sounding the alarm, saying this could be the beginning of the end of that era of good feeling. So my words, not his. But basically, that would be a concern, Bill. What do you think?
Well, I think it depends on how that proposal is introduced. What is the rhetorical framing around that proposal? If Biden puts out that proposal and says, this is my proposal, don't change a line of it, up or down vote, that's a far different tone saying, here's my proposal, let's talk, because border security can be added onto it in the negotiation process. So it's a question of how flexible Biden is signaling.
Yeah.
I mean, there's definitely an attitude in the progressive movement and the immigrant advocacy community that they don't want a comprehensive immigration bill that includes border security. They thought that Obama reached too far to the right and for naught, because it didn't even become a law. So they've even said they would prefer even smaller bills that didn't try to do everything all one fell swoop, if it meant they would not have to deal with the border security elements. I don't think that Biden's necessarily in that same mindset, but he might be trying to start this bid to try to maintain that base unity. But he might also signal the Republicans, hey, we're just starting this process here. Let's hear what you have to say about this.
One concern I have is, I mean, you know, Bill, I saw what, granted, it's not completely the same, but in the Republican Party, I saw what the immigration issue did to John McCain, what it did to Rick Perry, what it did to Newt Gingrich. And interestingly, ironically, it was often Mitt Romney who was demagoguing the issue, believe it or not, and scoring points against people who were not hardcore enough anti-immigration. So Mitt Romney, who's become something of a hero, even to yours truly, was able to use that issue very effectively. And it's an incredibly divisive issue. And look, Joe Biden should start with him, should do what Donald Trump should have done, right? Is start with infrastructure or something like that. If Joe Biden actually starts off with immigration reform as his sort of first big push, I just wonder if that isn't going to sort of strangle the baby in the crib. So
I think the first big push is a COVID relief bill.
Oh, yeah.
Which I suspect will include infrastructure.
Okay. But there's also, I agree with you on that. And I think, I mean, to me, COVID, I didn't even bring it up because to me, that's just built, that's baked into the cake. Like, that's obviously.
But not irrelevant here. I mean, Biden is saying he's going to introduce the immigration bill, I believe today, if not, or soon. Say here it is. It is introduced. I don't think the shoulder gets put into it right away. I think COVID relief is first and foremost. And Biden, I think, wants, he wants that honeymoon. He wants that inaugural address to strike that unifying note. So it's a lot harder for Republicans to start off in an obstructionist mindset.
Well, so, but there's also ACA.
Ooh, this one hurts.
Right?
Our special
right
guest stars are back, Matt.
Ooh, right in the heart. This one hurts.
Why'd you do that?
He took off his hairstyle on his head. And ooh. Right here. And right there.
Pull it right
and
in the
right
heart.
Excuse
me. This one hurts. What
ouch.
Do you do it?
Ouch, ouch, ouch.
What?
You are a good father, Bill.
Thank you.
Was it an election that you let them paint your nails or something?
I think that's right. That all, it all becomes a blur after a while.
You're a good dad. You're a good dad. That this is, you know, Bill, and I'm sure you think about this sometimes, hopefully. But in like, you know, 5 or 10 years, they're going to be, you know, they're not going to want to hang out with dad, probably, you know.
I'm gonna refrain commentary about about
well,
what
again,
that moment's gonna feel like.
Cat's in the cradle. You know what I'm saying?
I remember one time I was walking down the street when they were very, very small, and I think they were yelling at me, and some guy rolled out his window and was like, "Enjoy it now while they still like you."
There's truth in that, man.
Anywho, what do you make of the, you know, sort of split screen of Trump skipping town early, but Pence, Roy Blunt, Roy Blunt even made a very thoughtful comment about Obama's Amazing Grace speech. After Garth Brooks sang Amazing Grace, you know, if you call Obama sang Amazing Grace after the Charleston massacre.
I liked Obama's version better.
There's an argument there. Although, you know, the version that always sticks in my head is Marion Barry. When Marion Barry won election after he was imprisoned, he sang Amazing Grace. And I was living in D.C. at the time, so that always stuck in my head.
Couldn't he sing well?
It wasn't really belting it out. It was more kind of a bit more spoken word.
The song Amazing Grace, written by John Newton, a former slave ship captain who repented and lived the rest of his life sort of like a monk, making amends, trying to make amends.
Now, did McConnell and McCarthy go to Biden to church this morning? I heard that
that's what I heard.
So all these bipartisan grace notes are occurring while Trump skips town. And is there meaning behind that? Is the Republican Party, the remaining Republican Party, signaling we're going to do things differently this time around than we did under Trump
like
and under Obama?
I mean, it does seem like they are. Now, will they stick with it? Does this mean we should respect them more? Those are different questions. But you asked me, are they signaling? And I think that you have to say yes. Yes, they are.
Now, I wrote a piece for Real Clear Politics on Monday, speculating that if Republicans went as far as to convict Trump, because the impeachment's still out there, we still haven't had our trial. I don't think the articles have been brought over yet, unless they've happened today and I missed it. So once they get brought over, there'll be a trial. If Trump is convicted, there can then be a subsequent vote to bar him from ever running for office again. And I thought if Republicans took it that far, perhaps Trump would want to have his revenge by starting a third party. He couldn't run himself in it, but he could put up family members. He could endorse candidates. He could run candidates against the Republicans he feel betrayed him. And you would have, you know, potentially a significant political realignment that at least would hurt Republicans in the short run. And you could, and I said in the piece, Republicans could adapt in the long run. But in the short run, it would be obviously a blow. And then a day after I wrote that piece, we hear in the Wall Street Journal that Trump has been talking about doing just that with his aides. And he made a comment today about he'll be back in some form, which also seems to suggest he's thinking third party. Should Republicans be terrified of the prospect and maybe say, okay, maybe we won't convict him because we don't want to piss him off too much? Or should they say, you know what? He is a cancer on our party and he needs to be removed. And even if there is some short-term damage to us, we can't turn the page unless this guy is gone from our party completely.
I think the latter. I think one big lesson is just simply that you cannot mitigate Trump's damage. You cannot outweigh Trump. You cannot inherit his supporters. Like, any potential benefit is gone. And even the, you know, and, you know, Mitch McConnell even tried to navigate those waters and he got judges. But even someone as wily as Mitch McConnell lost his majority ship. So there is no, you play with matches, you're going to get burned and there will be pain. We are now in a, Republicans, conservatives are now sort of in a lose-lose proposition. There's no easy or good answer. There are better answers and worse answers. And so I think very clearly, you know, take your lumps now, take the pain now, and take Trump out. It's just sort of the Cobra Kai thing. I don't know if you're watching the Cobra Kai show, but, you know, John Kreese, the sensei, talks about no mercy. And I'm normally opposed to that philosophy, Bill, but in this case, sweep the leg. I think you need to take him out of commission. Donald Trump needs to be out of the political game because otherwise he's going to, you know, not to overextend the metaphor, but he's going to reanimate and throw you like down the steps of your school and possibly cause great damage to you. So get rid of him. Sweep the leg.
Now, in my piece, I talked about, you know, we have three instances of former presidents running as third party candidates. And in each case, it was damaging to their prior parties. Martin Van Buren was the first. He ran as a Free Soil candidate. And those were breakaway Democrats in the North who had turned against the expansion of slavery. They weren't hardcore abolitionists, but they turned against slavery expansion. And Martin Van Buren founded the Democratic Party as a geographic alliance between Southern planters, slaveholders, and Northern, quote-unquote, plain Republicans, who are more Jeffersonian purists and not Hamiltonian. And Van Buren, you know, turns against that. That was 1848. And then in that election, Taylor, the Whig candidate, wins. Now, I've heard people argue that you can't take all of Van Buren's votes and say they all were taken from Democrats. Some of them might have gone Whig on the slavery issue. But nevertheless, it wasn't helpful for the Democratic Party to have a breakaway faction. Then in 1856, it was six, or 56. It was 56. That's when Millard Fillmore, who was the Whig president after Taylor died, and by 56, the Whigs are already falling apart. They're already being racked with division over slavery, and the Northern anti-slavery Whigs are becoming Republicans, starting the Republican Party. And Fillmore joins the Know-Nothings, or the American Party, who were nativists, anti-Catholic, anti-immigrant. Even though Arlie Fillmore wasn't so nativist himself, but he didn't want to become a Republican, thought this was a better vehicle for national unity, and essentially put the nail in the Whigs' coffin. I mean, the Whigs were dying anyway, but the Whig convention happens, and they endorse the American Party and Millard Fillmore, and that's the last. And there never was a Whig nominee after that. And he wins the state, but the Democrats win. The Whig Party the Republicans don't win that election. And then you have most famously Teddy Roosevelt in 1912, when Roosevelt's running for the Republican nomination against the incumbent Taft. Roosevelt feels robbed at the convention, storms out, starts the Progressive Party. That splits the Republican Party in half, and Woodrow Wilson wins. Very few of his states were majority states. He won with pluralities in almost every state. Now, in the case of the Democrats in 1848 and the case of Republicans in 1912, those breakaway moments do not fatally destroy the party. They come back together in the subsequent election. In the Whig case, the party dies, but they create a new party. And so Republicans could look at what Trump might do to them and say, okay, he might take a whack at us in this election, but we can regroup the next election. He won't be able to keep it up. Or they could say, you know what? If he takes all the QAnon folks out and we have to reformulate in some other way and build a new coalition, so be it, because we weren't sustainable with the coalition that we had. So I think the historical examples, I think in all cases, give a hope that you can look at it as a realignment moment that you could work in your favor if you are savvy enough.
Yeah. So obviously the context here is that Trump is threatening, or people on Trump's behalf are threatening or suggesting that he might start a third party. And I, for one, say bring it on. I don't think he's going to do it. I don't think it's the kind of thing Donald Trump has the energy or time to do. But I don't think it's the worst possible thing, especially if we get to keep the Republican Party. This is a...
You know, I've heard the argument...
The infrastructure is very important to keep, and the brand, I think, despite the damage he has done to it. And so if Donald Trump were to basically purge all the bad people from this party and leave us the party, I can't imagine he would do that. That would be doing a huge favor, actually. And I think it's sort of like a divorce where you getting divorced isn't great for either party, but it's better if you get to keep the house. And so I say keep the house.
I mean, it's not just the infrastructure there. I mean, a lot of state laws give a lot of preferential treatment to existing parties, and it's hard to get on the ballot as a third party. So it's a harder road to start from scratch. And I've heard the argument that, you know, Trump's too lazy. Trump can't put in the effort. So he won't bore himself with all those difficult details. But, and again, I can't get in his head. But I would think that we know he wants to stay involved. He doesn't want to see the spotlight. We know he likes making money. I think it's going to be hard for him to make money now. He can only sell his wares and his services to his loyalists. He's not going to sell Trump steaks to the average person anymore. He has a shrinking base of diehards. I mean, it's not nothing. It's millions of people. So you could make some money that way, but
What if a million people each gave us $1 for our Patreon?
I mean, that would be a lot of money.
Let's make that happen.
But I think he will see an advantage, a financial advantage, to starting a party where you can fundraise off of all of your loyalists and steer that money to a collection of businesses that you also own. And you could do that grift in a way that your diehards won't care, because you've been doing that kind of grift from the get-go and they haven't been bothered by it before. So I think it is a vehicle to extend the grift and wreak havoc on the Republican Party.
Wouldn't a media venture do that easier without... And it wouldn't... There's no winning or losing. I mean, the problem with elections is they're actually points on the board. At some point, the game's over and you lose. But media.
But if he screws Republicans, he wins in his perverted, you know, nihilistic way.
I think he would screw them more. Not if he wants to screw them, he should stick around. By the way, a couple things I want to talk about too. One is the pardons in Ken Paxton, but we'll get back to that. Did you see that Chris Steerwalt, who has got fired from Fox News? Did you see that?
This is the guy on the decision desk?
Yeah. This is the guy. Very good. I know him a little bit. Our kids used to go to the same school, in fact. And he's from West Virginia, I believe. And he's been on my podcast. But he's the guy who is just really good at – I guess he's the Steve Kornacki of Fox News. And I remember in 2012 when Karl Rove tried to get him and his team to reverse their Ohio call for Obama, and he wouldn't do it, which I thought took a lot of guts, and he was right. And then this time around, you know, Fox made that call, and they were right about Arizona, and it really hurt Trump's efforts to steal the election. And for some reason, he is fired now from Fox.
Now, I don't think this guy is the top guy in the decision. I thought the top guy was Aaron Mishkin. I think it was Mishkin who was the guy who had said, I'm not going to budge in this call, but this other guy is on the team. And I don't know if Mishkin is a full-time employee of Fox. I think he just comes in for the elections. This guy seemed to be someone who sticks around.
Whatever the case may be, the perception is that Steerwalt is fired because of that Georgia call, he got right, by the way.
So, I mean, that decision by Fox seems to suggest they're worried about their ratings loss to Newsmax and OAN, or OANN, and
Maria Bartiromo, who is very irresponsible. She used to be a serious, Wall Street reporter once upon a time at CNBC, is apparently now trying out to be the 7 p.m. host for Fox News.
Which used to be more relative straight news hour.
Where Chris Steerwalt, who is behaved admirably and got things right, is fired. And Maria Bartiromo, who was, you know, behaved horribly in the past several years, is being potentially rewarded. So the incentives at Fox are all perverse, obviously. And it's a place, you know, I talk about this all the time on Twitter, but Hayek said, he was talking about the Soviet Union, but in a totalitarian regime, the worst get on top. You know, like Stalin. Why did Stalin make it to the top and not Bukharin or something, you know, or even, well, whatever, Trotsky or something? Why did Stalin make it to the top? Because the worst get on top. And I think it's kind of the same way maybe at Fox right now, at least based on what's happening in the last couple days.
Although, I mean, they have to play to the niche more than the Republican Party theoretically can. Republican Party has to win elections, and in most cases that means winning 50% plus one of the vote.
Right.
Fox doesn't need to win 50%. They need to have, you know, several million people watch their programming and, you know, buy products from their advertisers. They don't need to be a majority network.
Right. But then again, you know, so first of all, I think Fox has immense input on pressuring politicians. And as you know, it's one thing to have the intensity of support really matter. So in any event, it seems like Fox is going to be continuing to exert pressure on Republican politicians in such a way that would prevent them from doing the things that they ought to be doing if they want to get back to winning elections and being taken seriously.
So let me shift gears for a little bit. Do you want to talk pardons or you want to talk judges?
Well, I think I want to talk pardons real quick.
Okay.
I just think overall, yet another example of how Trump is, you know, it's the swamp. That's the obvious point. He talked about draining the swamp and, you know, rewarding or pardoning Steve Bannon is, you know, it's not surprising. The one guy who got really screwed is Ken Paxton, who, full disclosure, my wife was once a fundraising consultant for. He's the attorney general of Texas, who was under investigation, I think, by the FBI. And apparently, it seems like in order to help himself out, he was seeking a Trump pardon. So he became super Trumpy. He actually got a bunch of attorneys general around America to sign a letter seeking to, you know, overturn some of the elections. And then Ken Paxton apparently was involved. He actually was at the Stop the Steal rally and I think was involved in bringing other people there as well. And he didn't get pardoned by Trump, maybe because Trump didn't want to pardon anybody involved in the Stop the Steal, you know, debacle. So whatever the case, that guy, this is one guy who's sort of like waiting, you know, he's like, he's about to be executed and he's waiting for the governor to call, you know, and the phone call never came. Trump never didn't rescue him. So Trump left one of his MAGA guys on the field.
I mean, it seems like, I mean, was this a guy who has been charged?
I'd have to look up the details, but
okay. See, there seemed to be a reluctance to pardon anyone who wasn't charged with anything yet. So to sort of say you were at Stop the Steal, but you haven't been charged. I'm not going to go presuming you are guilty.
And they may have been. On July 28th. Well, that's an old one. So he was indicted 5 years ago.
Okay, so he has been indicted.
That was 5 years back in hot water. Anyway, we could look it up. But I have heard reports about authorities waiting to make arrests, not related to Ken Paxton, but just in general, because they don't want Trump to be able to pardon people. So, yeah.
Well, I'm struck by Paxton has not been charged in any federal court. So any pardon would have been preemptive. So that might be why he didn't make the list.
He was accused by top aides of abusing his office. And I think most of them, some of whom were highly respected in the conservative movement, quit his office and, you know, all at once and walked out. So and this was like a couple months ago.
So Trump spent a lot of energy this month on the pardons. Which of his crooked friends and allies should he pardon? And no time on judges. Hold on one second.
No time left for you.
Now, I find this very strange because we all know that Trump and McConnell have been a judge confirming machine for the last 4 years. And is practically the only reason why McConnell tolerated Trump for as long as he did. And at the end of the previous Congress, which ended on January 3rd, there are about 54 vacancies remaining, almost all district level. Yeah, there's district courts, appellate courts, Supreme Court. They filled up almost all the appellate courts. They only have two vacancies on the appellate courts. They got 52 district level court seats. They had 27 judges nominated that didn't get confirmed before the Congress ended. And then when the new Congress was sworn in, Trump only renominated three of them, and none of them got confirmed. So I don't, and I've seen no reporting on this. I don't know what is involved in that decision making, whether it's true neglect or something deliberate.
I can find out. This is one area. If you want to explore it, I think I could. I think I could talk to some people.
I'm genuinely curious, like, why you wouldn't jam
through.
You're
the only person. And I tweeted that you had a shareable on this.
Yeah, I did spend my midnight hour, my final shareable YouTube of the Trump era, exploring this question, because I wrote a piece back in June for the Washington Post arguing that the devil's bargain for judges was a bad deal for Republicans, largely based on the probability Trump would not get reelected, and as good a pace he had in confirming lower court judges, if you only get one term, that doesn't count for very much. Because, you know, Obama had 327 judges, and Bush had 326, and Clinton had, I think it was 376. So Trump ends up with 231 lower court judges. That's real nice for one term. Way to go, buddy. But now Biden's in with a 50-50 Senate where they have the tie-breaking vote. And he can fill all the judges. To extent that there are vacancies. I mean, I don't know if he will flat out neutralize all of those 231, but the net gain goes down pretty quickly. And this is just
and he starts off flipping 20 some judges, right?
Well, I mean, he's got to nominate them. You know, he's got to nominate the judges. You know, I think the Biden team is going to vet better than the
Trump
team.
But those are like losing. In a sense, it's like losing two. You know, I mean, those would have been Republican judges.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if all the – I don't know what the party affiliations were of the people that left.
Yeah.
So that I think that would depend on –
Yeah, fair point. I don't get it. But, I mean, I guess one theory is Trump was too busy trying to overturn the election and pardon cronies to do judges. The other assumption I think would be – he's just pissed off at Mitch McConnell, right? I mean, in Mitch McConnell, it's been like a month now, probably, since Mitch McConnell basically turned on him.
But he didn't turn on him. He didn't turn on him on January 3rd. I mean, why weren't they having a conversation on January 3rd saying, give me all 27, and if you can add on some more, that would be great, and I'll ram these through by the 19th.
McConnell did, though. What was the day? What was the day when what was the day that McConnell first turned on him?
The insurrection is the 6th.
Yeah, but didn't McConnell give a speech basically turning on him? Was it Safe Harbor Day? Or I don't even know. There were like four different dates where I was like, if we just get past this date, Biden, I feel like it was like a month ago. And granted, time has gone weird.
No, you're right. McConnell did already signal we shouldn't reject the electoral count before the 6th.
Didn't McConnell congratulate Biden like a month ago?
I would double check the date, but I think you are right. There is
once again. No, it still remains, even if assuming I'm right.
Right, December 16th. Okay. December 16th. So you are correct on that score.
Over a month ago. But then it's still, we still don't know if that is why, but that's a theory.
Right. But even, I mean, it's Trump's, it's as much Trump's legacy too. He likes to brag about judges. Maybe McConnell wants them more. But in any event, it didn't happen. And now the argument that Republicans got the better of the deal is really hinges on Supreme Court, because the edge Trump has in the lower courts is not going to hold. I mean, there's always going to be a churn on the lower courts. So right. In addition to the 54 vacancies that are out there, there are 40, about 40 appellate level judges who are democratically appointed, who are eligible for senior status, which have a quasi-retirement. So you don't totally quit. You can still work on some cases, but you leave your permanent seat, and that can be filled. And Ed Whelan, who writes for National Review and does their Bench Memos blog, has said, you know, he'll probably get most folks to take that offer. And Biden will probably get more appellate level judges in his first year than Trump got in his first year. So we don't know the exact numbers yet, but I think Biden's going to have a good run with judges to some degree. Supreme Court is the big unknown. Obviously, a 6-3 court looks very good from the Matt Lewis Republican perspective. I still think you can't declare how big a win that is until you see more cases get heard and decided. And one thing that I've been keeping my eye on is the Mississippi 15-week abortion ban case. If they're going to gut Roe, overturn Roe right away, you would take that case, rule on it by June, and be done with it. And they have, so there's a conference that gets held to decide whether to take a case. The Supreme Court punted that case 8 times. Apparently had a conference about it, I think 2 weeks ago, but didn't come to a decision whether to take it. And it was rescheduled again, I think for this week. Forgive me if I'm not fully up to date on that, but at least they've not decided to take it yet. And they still could, I can't predict, but they could have taken it sooner and they haven't, which suggests to me great hesitation to want to move that quickly to do something that dramatic within Amy Coney Barrett's first year. And the slower they move, the more chance that someone retires or somebody dies and Biden gets to fill that seat.
Yes, we shouldn't discount the notion that things change, right? And maybe Clarence Thomas should have retired, a couple months ago, whoever. It doesn't have to be him. He's old though. He's older than we think he is, right?
Well, not as old as Ginsburg was or Breyer. Breyer is the oldest now. I believe Alito is 72 and Thomas is 70.
Wait, Alito's 72?
Yeah. Thomas has been there forever because he got named when he was 12 years old. So.
All right.
So there's no obvious reason to assume they're in poor health. There's no obvious reason to assume they can't be on there for another 10 years. But no one knew Scalia was going to have a heart attack. You don't know. And Roberts has had his health problems, too. Thomas is 72. Thomas is 72. I might have flipped them.
Alito feels younger also. Alito seems younger.
Well, because he's been there for a shorter period of time. And, they both seem fine. 70.
Where I come from, when I was a kid, if you were 70, you were like 100 pounds overweight. You'd been smoking a couple packs of Marlboro Reds a day for about 60 years, probably. Maybe did a little time in prison, possibly worked in a coal mine or something or other factory. So, you might not look as good as, let's say, if you're rich old.
I think you get treated pretty well as Supreme Court justice. You can stay fit. As Ginsburg did for a very long time. I mean, you don't have to be a Scalia. Other folks can, stay fighting trim, which I think, Thomas and Alito have been. I'm just saying you never know. You never know. And because there's this randomness to it, it's very hard for one party and one ideological faction to really have a long-term grip on the institution. Now, we don't know how long the Democrats will hold the White House. We don't know how long Democrats will hold the Senate. But pendulums swing.
Yeah. And let me ask you this. On day one of Joe Biden's presidency, will he be the Democratic nominee in 4 years?
I mean, I think barring a health problem, I would assume so at this point. He might have a totally disastrous 4 years and have an approval rating of 30% by 2023. And maybe people second guess that.
I talk to people who are like 100%. There's no chance Biden will be the nominee.
If you asked me 6 months ago, I would say probably not. Now I think he's proven himself the Trump killer. He's proven himself the ability to win in places that are hard for Democrats to win. And so long as he is healthy and so long as he is doing an adequate job, people will be reluctant to take a flyer on somebody else. And Kamala has work to do. Kamala is yet to prove herself able to win in these swingier areas. I think she can, but I think she has to put an effort to become a more familiar presence in these communities. So people are on the Democrats are not going to jump to taking a chance on somebody if you got, you know, old reliable who's still looking okay.
Old reliable. You know, Jackson was old hickory, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Why don't we do nicknames anymore? Why can't Joe Biden be old reliable?
Maybe he will be old reliable.
I think you might have coined a phrase there. Okay. I like that.
You know, there's not a lot of other Bidens. There's not a lot of people in the Biden mold in the Democratic ranks because the Democrats have become more of a urban, suburban, college-educated party.
You got Sherrod Brown.
Who doesn't seem to really want the job. He had the chance to run the show and didn't take it.
Manchin's
up there in age. Manchin is 73, I believe. You know, there's Tester, but, you know, Tester doesn't seem itching for that job. Brown, Manchin, Tester are the three Senate Democrats in 2020 Trump states. And you only have John Bel Edwards and Andy Beshear as governors in Trump won states.
Maybe Connor Lamb, the congressman from Pennsylvania.
Well, Pennsylvania is still a very key state, and I think Connor Lamb is very ambitious, and I think Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman is very ambitious. You know, Fetterman is this big, burly, 6'8" former mayor, talks like a regular guy, but pretty progressive in his stances, very identified with legalized marijuana, has a wife who was an undocumented immigrant, very social media savvy.
What's his last name?
Fetterman.
Sounds like somebody. Have you been watching the Bridgerton?
No.
He sounds like somebody would be like on that show. So you haven't been watching Cobra Kai or Bridgerton?
I have not.
These are the two. I've finished both seasons. And these are the two. If you had to say, like, what are the two opposite ends of Netflix shows? I think that would be it.
Fetterman's exploring a run for Senate. Fetterman, two T's. Fetterman.
Fetterman.
Fetterman's exploring a Senate run. So the Senate seat is open. Toomey's not running again. And the governor's seat is open. I believe the governor is term limited.
One time I went paddleboarding with Pat Toomey.
He's an interesting guy at this point. He's been acting very unpredictable in his final 2 years of office. So anyway, Lamb has to decide if he's going to run against Fetterman for Senate, if he's going to run for governor, or if he's going to stay put. And if you're watching Lamb closely, you know, he ran for the House the first time, sitting very moderate, waving his gun around, not jumping on board with $15 minimum wage. And he has sounded more and more partisan as of late. You know, he called Republicans liars during the Electoral College.
Trump has that effect on people, though. I've sounded more partisan. I've sounded more like a partisan.
Well, it's partly that his district got redrawn, so he has a more Democratic district than when he first ran, although it's still a bit close. And he's talking about running in a Democratic primary for governor or Senate, and so he's thinking about, you know, distinguishing himself in that respect. So I think you got two ambitious Pennsylvania guys who have some moderate or some regular Joe cred who, if they do win statewide office, you'll hear a lot of presidential talk for either one of them or possibly both if they both win statewide elections in 2022.
Harris Lamb.
Harris Fetterman, if I was to put money on someone today to succeed Biden, whether it's 24 or 20, and I would say Harris Fetterman.
You should put that. You should make that bet today because I think you'll get great odds because no one's ever heard of him. And so,
well, I mean, if you ran in more Democratic circles, you would have heard of him.
You're probably right. Sure. Well, it is inauguration day. Should we leave it at that, Bill?
I think we can leave it there. Welcome to the Biden presidency. We survived. Thank you for your part in the primary to bring this about, even though you copped out in the general.
Well, in fairness to me, let me say, number one, I did vote for Biden, and I was in Virginia in the primary. I would argue that vote mattered. Then I moved to West Virginia, where I don't think my non-vote mattered. And even if it did, I would argue that my commentary, and I'm not pretending that I'm the most influential writer, but I would still argue that my commentary and my writing is way more significant than my one vote in West Virginia.
I'll allow it.
So I feel like I'm
in the magnanimous spirit of the Biden presidency. I will allow you to to be a pundit in good standing.
And then I would also say, would not you, Bill? Let's take you out of it. If this situation were reversed, how many progressive, commentators or columnists would have voted for like Mike Pence or something, or Roy Blunt maybe is a better example, to stop Kanye or to stop Avenatti? And we won't. I don't know the answer, but it's tough. It's tough going against your team. And again, I don't like to use the word hero when I describe myself, but other people have said that.
I mean, it would depend on the specifics of the candidate, how corrosive to the fabric of democracy that candidate was portraying themselves as. I mean, Huey Long, was a dictator of Louisiana. That is not a guy who respected democratic norms.
He did not.
And we'll never know how many votes he would have gotten if he ran against FDR in 1936 because he was murdered.
If FDR hadn't had him killed, it could have been really bad. But
now you're spreading bad rumors, Matt. I don't think we're at a place where we can make such jokes yet. There's just too many people that take things literally.
Well, I read that on a Reddit thread, Bill. So it has to be true.
All right, we made it. We survived.
Congratulations. I'm sorry. And we'll see you in the DMZ next week.
All right, take care.